This week on the PhD Cast, we're discussing Susan Wojcicki's vision for YouTube as it enters its third great age of engaging advertisers and audiences alike. We talk the future of broadcast, how digital is changing content, how we watch it, and what it means for advertisers and brands. This is the PhD Cast from PhD Australia. Erica Stevenson joining me on this pre-Easter PhD Cast, our PhD Cast regulars, Jess Young.
Hello.
And Christian Zvar.
Hello.
How are you guys doing?
Good.
Really good.
Excited for Easter.
Excited for Easter. It's chocolate time. Also joining us, and God, and also joining us on the PhD Cast this week, it's only Lucy Formosa Morgan.
Hello.
PhD's National Head of Training. How are you doing?
You well and cool
and
good? Thank you.
Are you excited about Easter?
Lots of chocolate.
And chocolate and God.
Yeah. Chocolate. Thinking about God.
As Alistair Campbell once said, we don't do God on the PhD Cast. Right, let's go straight into it. This week we're focusing on an interview that Susan Wojcicki has given. She is the new head of YouTube, and she's described YouTube as entering its third phase, I suppose, of its existence. She says you could categorise the first evolution of YouTube's business, which was how do we make money from YouTube, and that resulted in, of course, TrueView. And I'm assuming that most people listening to this media podcast are familiar with what TrueView is on YouTube, but also set off the partner program to share revenue with creators. The second era was to make the content better. YouTube spending around about $100 million US a year to those creators to carve out channels in really advertising rich verticals. And now we get to the third stage, which is what this interview is talking about in this third age, which is all about now actually growing audiences. Google, the world's single biggest seller of advertising, has decided it needs to buy some to boost one of its brands, as in YouTube, just as CBS, ABC, and Fox do. Those companies, the article points out, spend tens of millions of dollars on advertising, not to mention promoting their own networks, but to launch new shows. Now, YouTube will be doing a lot of tried and true tuning advertising over the next few years, using media as it's trying to disrupt. YouTube and its third great evolution, advertising to grow programs, content. This is incredibly familiar for anyone who runs a TV network. Why is it so unusual that YouTube and Google are doing this?
I think what she pointed out in the article as well, and it's quite interesting, is it's really true and it's really obvious, but still I'm not sure. I'm quite familiar with this direction they are taking right now, or I quite understand exactly what they would like to do. But ultimately, they have loads of YouTube stars who have millions and millions of viewers. But apart from those millions of viewers, actually, nobody's is really aware of it. So what she pointed out in the article as well is that it was a natural organic growth that actually created this huge mass fan clubs, and this organic growth obviously kind of stopped, but they realized the huge potential of these people if they are also realized by other people outside of the territories of Google, the realm of Google, and this is what they would like to boost up in the future and actually make these YouTube stars basically like channel stars or movie stars, so give them an even bigger exposure.
So it's essentially a project in boosting the profile of YouTube's biggest stars.
Mm. Well, I thought it was interesting that it was mentioned that they're going to be using the media that they're trying to disrupt. So they will be using TV ads, billboards, subway wraps, and interestingly, magazine pages, which I thought it was a little bit odd, just because it's audiovisual content that they're,
But I guess magazines, in terms of if you're targeting niche content like cuckoo or fashion, magazines is an obvious place to go.
My question is, do they own the talent? You know, with the networks, for example, they own key talent. They then cross-promote them within Sunrise, within Today Show, or, you know, various other shows. does Google own the talent, or how, you know, I'm assuming there's some lengthy logistics and legal contracts that would have to go on behind the scenes.
I'm guessing they kind of don't. I mean they own the platform, and so the creators are dependent on the YouTube platform for an audience. And because they own the platform, they co-share revenues with those creators, so they're incentivizing them to stay there. Because not only do they use YouTube to get an audience, but they then get revenue from YouTube. Owning the creators, I suppose, is less important than owning the platform, because that's what they're selling. They're selling the platform.
But, but with the TV networks, they're then putting them into the other shows that they own the content of. So, you know, how would they then use the... You know, I can't find the name in front of me. You know, the top cooks. How would they then cross promote, other than going into traditional media, per se? You know, are they going to put them into other YouTube shows, or how else would they do it?
I think this is a really interesting question, and this is what one of the commenters actually also pointed out. I don't know if you read the comments after the like below the article, but what she said as well, that for instance. She's saying that even when YouTube gets an opportunity to showcase its own premier content, it doesn't pull it off there. So she brings YouTube Music Awards as an example, and also she says she brings the Coachella Music Festival as an example, and she's raising also the question, did they integrate YouTube stars / YouTube programs into the webcast as the broadcast networks do with the Super Bowl?
Yeah.
No, they didn't. So this is, I think, still a huge untapped potential that they are not leveraging on it. But back to their question whether actually they are owning the people, and asking whether it's important for those stars actually at all, because what YouTube is doing right now is just going to them and knocking on the door and basically saying to them that, guys, I'm going to make you even more money. Because ultimately, because of the share of the revenue, I think it would be quite interesting if they said, no, I'm fine with 1.2 million followers. I don't want 2 million followers, because ultimately they're going to generate so much more money out of it.
More than we've got. I don't think we're quite at 1 million followers yet for our podcast.
Not yet. I reckon it would be interesting.
Should we ask for the followers to actually post something or shout out?
We should totally do this on YouTube, though.
Yeah.
We can make a really cool... Jess is making a face now. See, that was on YouTube. We can see... Our viewers could see your face. They could see the face you're making
right now.
You
could be the next meme.
Oh, yes. Brilliant. I reckon it would be interesting... for Google to take on someone from the networks, one of the networks, you know, and just get that different perspective in there rather than an engineer's perspective and, you know, very much a digital-only approach, which is what they've done in the past, and that's what this feedback, you know, from Tracy Hill says, is they haven't been looking at it from a TV network's perspective. It'd just be interesting to get someone in there, you know, to be able to really exploit it using... their experience too.
Is it not happening in the market actually? Yeah, because I mean, obviously, I'm from a different market, and what I saw there locally is what happened is they were actually poaching people from big TV network to actually work in the sales department of
in sales,
YouTube.
But not on the creative.
Yeah, but isn't it a question of future proofing yourself as well? Because it's not only sales.
But also, who's got most to learn here? I mean, who's going to learn the most? YouTube poaching people who make programs on TV, how much have Google got to learn and YouTube got to learn versus TV networks actually poaching engineers, short form content creators?
I think it's both, you know, both ways should be happening.
Yeah, in the article it references Disney. Disney, of course, famously bought Pixar quite a while ago now. Disney have recently bought Maker Studios, which is a YouTube channel operator, in a deal that could again be nearly $1 billion. Disney spending a cool billion on acquiring people who are expert in making short form content and building an audience with short form content.
Yeah.
I mean, is the future short form?
I think it depends on the format. Yeah, if you're watching on YouTube or the internet, you know, whatever it would be, I think it is, you know, more short form, more snack type content. But I think, you know, you still look at the number of people watching TV these days, and, you know, they're watching hour episodes, they're sitting down and watching, you know, box sets for a whole weekend. I think they're happy to sit down as long as the content's right.
And we are talking about as well how binge viewing is getting more and more important, and it basically I think definitely short form content and bite-sized content has its place as well, but binge-reading and proper longer format quality content will still be there and will always be important.
I think it's dependent on the audience as well. Like the younger audience probably doesn't mind the short form content. But yeah, I think it's all going to be evolving, and there's always going to be people that would prefer to watch, you know, traditional television. But I mean, I think that's going to be different in a couple of years' time.
I think what's really interesting as well is when we are talking about short form and long form, there is a reason why there is no short format in television, and there is, and the fact. Just think about how TV operates different and generally than on-demand. And I think this is, at the same time, yes, on-demand is going to be increasing and it's really important, but at the same time, what TV is nailing really importantly is it's just so simple, it's so easy. It doesn't actually require any thinking of me, it doesn't require viewer action. They're just serving a content to me on a silver platter. And I'm wondering what if you put YouTube into the same context. Like if you had a YouTube channel, you just go on YouTube, right? And it starts showing you, serving you content that's just generally there in the push form. You can still actually cherry pick your on-demand stuff if you don't like what you see. But whether that could be an interesting way.
Well, that's what they say in here that they're trying to move towards, is that not on demand, but you know, cherry pick the key programs or key channels that you want to go in and watch and make it appointment to view.
And when you say that, you mean an advertiser can
Google.
Go into Google
and wanting viewers to go in and watch.
And what is this in many ways, this is this move by Google, this move by YouTube to use billboards, TV ads, print to promote what is a very digital platform. It's a huge vote of confidence in those other media to build an audience, right?
Mm.
Yeah, and I think it's serving the purpose that we always talk about. It's tries to build further penetration, although it obviously has a high penetration as a platform in itself, but these particular channels we're talking about don't. And this is what they're trying to push people to do it. What's interesting for me though as well is whether it's a more valuable or is it first to do it outside of the realms of digital and push it out to outdoor on billboards as opposed to just riding an already existing behavior because people are consuming YouTube, whether it would be more easier for them as well just to push their content out there and actually bring people into those channels. Because there's obviously a huge penetration of YouTube users already, so will it boost the general YouTube user penetration just to put it out there in outdoor?
But I reckon they could be really clever with, you know, the traditional advertising as well. You know, there's a lot of stuff you could do, like use viewer, you know, if you're doing print ads,
yeah.
For example, use a viewer type app, you know, bring the content alive that way, you know, be it through outdoor and their digital screens now. There's so much they could do to make it more interactive than just a straight two-way conversation.
And arguably there's more they have to do as well,
yeah.
Because with proliferation of not just TV channels but with proliferation of platforms and proliferation of formats, short form, longer form, box sets, now Google Play Store, got iTunes, there is a lot of content and infinite ways to view that content. Is it getting harder to build an audience for content?
Yes, I definitely do feel that it's getting harder, and also content producers, I think this is what we were discussing as well a couple of weeks ago, content producers need to be very aware of the fact that this fragmentation is happening and the different channels or different platforms actually serve different purposes and use those platforms accordingly. If you have only bite-sized content that you want to showcase, then you use a different platform versus you have half an hour of purely quality material, and I think this is what we are, and content producers are not nailing at the moment yet.
I mean, it is perhaps one of the great media stories or media issues of our times. Certainly, if you're on a network, and at least you're probably more qualified than certainly any one of us to talk about that. But presumably, a few years ago, if a peak show had got a million viewers, you'd be like, yeah, cool, whatevs. Now, if you get a million viewers of a weekday night, the champagne corks are popping, right?
Yeah, there are fewer shows getting above that mark, and certainly, you know, the big ticket items, MKR or, you know, The Block, getting over 2 mil or around that 2 mil is, you know, something to absolutely rave about, just because there's so much more choice. You know, 5 years ago, whatever, 6 years, 5 years, you know, there were only three commercial free-to-air channels, and now, look, you know, it's a completely different landscape from a TV perspective alone. Just TV, it's changed, and then you've got obviously online, YouTube and all the other streaming, opportunities.
Game of Thrones is a good example of that, because I think Australia had the highest
piracy.
Number of, piracy, like downloading legally online, and
there you go.
I mean, that was going to air on Foxtel.
Yep.
15 minutes in, everyone. It wouldn't be a PhD cast without a Game of Thrones reference. And those of you out there who had 15 minutes, you're the winner of this week's Spot the Game of Thrones reference conversation. And has it changed the expectations of media agencies? Has it changed your expectation? When we as an agency sit down with Channel 7 or Channel 9 or Channel 10, is there a different expectation? Has it changed expectation of what a programme will perform at?
No, I mean, we're still, you know, buying, you know, the negotiations are all based on CPM, so, you know, the numbers are taken into account. I think what will change is when HBB TV comes into effect, you know, which launches next month.
And for anyone who doesn't know, HBB TV.
With smart TVs being able to go, you know, watch effectively streaming online through your TV set and, you know, do a lot more video on demand and things like that. You know, I think when that gets more prevalent, things change. In terms of the networks will probably, I would assume, change the pricing structure, that the big ticket items have a completely different price tag to more your CPM buy, and you're just buying eyeballs. With the lower engagement
stuff. And is CPM, obviously, for anyone who doesn't know, is a cost per 1,000 views. So it's the cost that a media agency will pay for 1,000 views, not necessarily 1,000 people, but 1,000 views of your content. Is CPM is for broadcast, not necessarily TV versus online, but what is the difference between a CPM for broadcast versus CPM for an on-demand?
So catch up. Because limited content, or limited supply, catch-up TV, the CPM is completely different to what TV CPM. So
it's a lot higher, right?
Double, triple, yeah. In some cases, depending on the show itself. You know, whereas you can buy video, so not your catch-up TV, and that's a far more cost-efficient way from a CPM perspective.
And these presumably are the constant debates and conversations and benchmarking that as a media agency we'd have as platforms and behaviours and different content emerges.
Yeah, I think that, you know, how we need to move is being able to monitor across both video online and then also TV, so that you can look at it holistically rather than siphoning cash off to digital. Versus what you're putting on TV.
Because the win state for us as an agency and our clients is that one universal currency that we can apply to content. No matter where it's viewed or how it's viewed, there's a currency that's applied and there's a value that's paid for advertising that interrupts or augments or runs alongside that content.
Yeah.
And what's the roadmap to that? What's the roadmap to that universal currency? Are we a year away? Are we 10 years away?
I don't think we're 10 years away. I think we're a couple of years away, probably. But, you know, the conversations have been going on for years now to try and get that that singular panel, I guess. Nielsen is certainly looking into it in the States, so you'd hope that it will then flow down over here. But, you know, it's a good couple of years away.
Smart TVs for everyone, then.
Smart TVs all around.
Yes.
And what does this mean for the future of broadcast? If you're running a TV network right now, are you, do you think these guys are looking to move into online distribution? Do we think that they're looking to diversify how they get content out of people? That's obviously got implications for rights management and all of that. What's the mood? What's the feeling? What's going on in networks right now in terms of finding their emerging place in a world where YouTube is about spending an awful lot of money advertising their stars alongside alongside The Good Wife or alongside Big Bang Theory or whatever it is?
I think they've been slow to change, definitely, and you know they're finally coming around, but it's certainly taken them a fair few years to actually accept that people, you know, people's consumption habits have changed, and they are watching a lot of, you know, catch up TV or online. You look at the Foxtel Go service, and I think it's a fantastic application, and you know the free to airs is slowly moving in that direction, but yeah, they're still not there yet.
I think it's also an interesting question that we're talking a lot about content and the quality of content and how important it is, and still, if you just think about the fact that YouTube never had so far a Game of Thrones, second Game of Thrones remark, but they never had a Game of Thrones that would actually would really, really be like on a broader, bigger scale, able to attract
which are millions of people just waiting, not for the broadcast, but for the upload.
Exactly.
I think that's an interesting approach. Like, will Google go that way in terms of it's launching right now and trying to push people to that appointment of view? Rather than you can go on there and watch it, but really trying to get that minute in time.
Because the whole idea of appointment of view is so different, because you still get appointment of view on YouTube, but what it is an email which says so-and-so to which you subscribe just uploaded a video.
Yeah.
So that's the appointment, but the appointment is very much one-on-one rather than at a certain time, at a certain day, you've got to be in front of a box. At home.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, I don't know apart from the fact that, yes, it's going to be important, or it's always important when you know that particular content is up there, because then you're going to go over there and watch it. Is it important, though? Because then it's going to remain on that platform forever, so you can watch it tomorrow, or you can watch it the next week.
But it's all about, TV is all about the water cooler. MKR, for example, the profits that water cooler conversation. So, if Google are trying to push their stars, are they trying to get to that water cooler moment of people coming into work the next day and saying, oh, did you watch it?
Is TV still about the water cooler?
I think it is.
Definitely.
For the key shows, definitely.
Yeah.
I don't think it's as much. Big Brother certainly doesn't get the conversation, but there are certain shows that, yes, people are still coming in to discuss.
All of the reality shows, MKR and The Block and stuff like that.
Yeah,
good examples of that.
And from a planning perspective, what are the implications for brands and how they communicate in this emerging world and these multitude of platforms? What are the biggest implications for brands, do we think?
Well, it's integration. With cooking shows, they talk in the Google article about cooking shows and lifestyle and things. There's certainly integration opportunities there that need to be exploited. I don't think they've been exploited to this. To the extent that we see on TV these days.
And also, one really clear tactical implication of it is the fact that if you see a particular kitchen equipment, for instance, that one of these YouTube stars would be using, you are literally one click away of actually purchasing right from the content itself. So I think it's also a kind of interesting implication that it's not necessarily going to be just a brand job, but right away you can right away drive purchase.
Yeah, and the whole emergence of e-commerce is a whole thing that these new platforms allow that we haven't begun to think about. And certainly, as TVs do become streaming and online, e-commerce could be a huge thing in and of itself, right?
Yeah.
What could be an interesting question around it as well, though, is whether if something like this happens, then obviously it's gonna, so that the potential revenue of those people who are responsible for those channels, those stars, is gonna just increase and increase, and who's gonna be the guardian of that revenue now? Because Because yes, you have a show where you use actually a kitchen appliance, but I'm giving you the platform. I think that's an interesting question, because then it's going to be difficult to decide who's going to share.
But certainly from a brand's perspective, the potential to overlay with, you like that KitchenAid appliance, click on this and straight, go through and purchase now, is certainly quite a sexy offering.
Cool, well, that's pretty much all we've got time for this week. You can find that article on Advertising Age. It is with Susan Wojcicki, who is the recently appointed CEO of YouTube. That's it from us. Everyone looking forward to their Easter? Any plans?
Kid stuff, Easter egg hunts.
Friends all there, so lots of fun. Lots of jellies being royal looking for.
Probably a bit of drinking. Just to be honest.
Well, I'm going to get in my car and go west. I will be here next week. The PhD cast will be back next week. Have amazing, wonderful Easter's all. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. To get more from PhD Australia, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or find us on Google+ @PhD Australia.